Welcome back to this encore episode of Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Jonathan Kaufman's book, Hippie Food, introduces readers to food that dramatically changed American menus and eating habits. Think tofu, brown rice, and something called granola. He also introduces us to the people who started these changes. CAP Radio Reads host Donna Appadoni talked with Kaufman in front of a live audience in April of 2019. He explains how his interest in so-called hippie food began.
I was a restaurant critic starting in my late 20s. I'd cooked in higher-end restaurants. About 10 years into my run as a restaurant critic, maybe about 10 years ago, I liked to review restaurants all up and down the spectrum. So, you know, from the highest-end tasting menus to, you know, little pho shops and taco trucks. And I took some friends with me to go to a vegetarian restaurant in Seattle that had been there for like 30 years. My friends were my age, and I'm in my mid to late 40s, and so we were all born in the early 70s. We sat down to this meal, and it was this food that, like, it was so familiar to me, but I hadn't seen it in a long time. Steamed cauliflower with tahini lemon sauce and nut loafs, really brown, dense baked goods in the case, and, you know, and they had a drawing of two different hippies on the bathroom doors, and I just was like, oh my gosh, I love this. And it was food that I had just, you know, I'd sort of poo-pooed so long that I had forgotten to think about and consider in the same way that I was considering all the other food that I was writing about, to look at its origins, to look at it in context.
Did you take it for granted because it was your baby food?
Yeah. And that it kind of moved beyond. You know, so much of my teens and 20s, when I was teaching myself to cook and then working in restaurants, it was really all about learning high-end cuisine and French technique. So this was the food that, you know, it just didn't taste good. So when I was tasting this food at this restaurant, I started thinking, well, where did this really come from? And why were my parents, who weren't hippies, cooking this in the 1970s? And how did it make it to small towns in Indiana back then, when I sort of thought about it as a place of food that would have come out of Seattle rather than Elkhart, Indiana?
Some of what we think of as hippie food just really kind of warms our hearts and makes us feel really good inside. And you could say that of the food you grew up with. Your parents took a different path and started feeding you hippie food. What caused that? What inspired them?
So I grew up Mennonite, and so my, you know, many, many generations of Mennonite and Amish, my family was. But in the 1970s, Mennonites all up and down the spectrum from conservative to liberal, but particularly liberal Mennonites like my parents were. My parents were as far left as you could get and still kind of call yourself Mennonite. They and their friends really, you know, they were very politically aware. If they weren't necessarily socially very liberal, I mean, you know, they sort of believed a lot of the values around family and sort of sin and salvation, those were pretty, a little more conservative. But Mennonites were very active in the peace movement and very active in social justice movements.
Still are.
And still are, yeah. And so there was this cookbook that came out in 1976 called More with Less. And it was published by Doris Jansen Longacre, and it compiled a lot of recipes that were contributed by Mennonites who had done relief work all around the world, but then filtered them all through this sort of post-diet for a small planet, hearty, you know, whole grains and soybeans ingredients. So diet for a small planet was what all of my friends and I grew up eating. And it was when you went to a church potluck, like half of the dishes were desserts because we were still Mennonites. And if you weren't going to drink and if you weren't going to smoke, at least you could have sugar.
Pie. Absolutely. You need pie.
At least a quarter of them would be in crock pots. Yeah. They were all these bean casseroles.
As you were researching and then writing, was there a person or an event that just jumped out at you and said, that's like the best thing I could find out about hippie food?
That was the best part about it, is I kept finding new rabbit holes to explore. The first one that really struck me was when it was really right as I was beginning my research, my first chapter I decided to do on brown rice. And I thought, brown rice, who do I know who's involved with brown rice? And I went to talk to the Lundberg brothers. There were two of them who were still alive at the time. I think one has passed away. I drove out to Richvale, California, and they set up a whole spread. I mean, the owners of this like multi-million dollar farm, you know, sort of decided to spend the day with me telling me stories. And so we're talking about their father and, you know, the Dust Bowl and making it out to the land and why they decided to start growing organically. And then they were like, I said, well, do you know anything about macrobiotics? Because every time I think about macrobiotics, I think brown rice. And they said, oh, well, the whole reason we converted to organics was because of macrobiotics. And that just started this, got me on this whole long, year-long research project of interviewing macrobiotic folks all around the country, and had no idea how influential they were. And I didn't realize also how out there macrobiotics was in its origins. I sort of thought of it as that thing where, oh, it'd be brown rice with, you know, some greens and really dour food, you know. But the founder of macrobiotics, George Osawa, was just, he was a kook, but a very, very, very far-seeing one.
Say a little bit about kook. How would you define that in his case?
So if you read the first book that came out that he published, which was Zen Macrobiotics, which came out in they first published it in America in the early 1960s. He has sections where he's talking a lot. He's introducing Americans to concepts of yin and yang and you know, the twin forces that rule the universe, pulled straight from, you know, a lot of traditional Eastern philosophy. But then he starts talking about how, you know, if you eat more gomashio, which is toasted sesame seeds and salt, you'll make more friends. And, you know, smoking is totally healthy because it actually yangizes your body. It moves from, like, talking about how the American diet leads to obesity and heart disease and diabetes and maybe cancer to then making these kind of wild pronouncements.
You're talking about him as a kook, but he was a pretty popular kook.
What's fascinating is you can't necessarily separate the stuff that felt overly, you know, that feels very eccentric to me from the stuff that it feels like it's the template for, you know, modern day health and the way we look at nutrition and health,
right,
you know.
Right. Los Angeles played a big role in the early part of this, and we've come to gradually see Los Angeles change so much into this, what it is now. We forget that it was a place for people to go to recuperate. And that's when a lot of this took place, a lot of the early health food movement. It always sounds funny to me to say health food, like they're two different things.
Back when the railroad first connected Los Angeles to the East Coast, it became a destination for tuberculosis sufferers. And so in the 1890s, there were sanatoriums all over the city. And then people just kept coming out for the climate and for sort of a beneficial environment. And then when Hollywood started up, it added in this layer of all the beautiful young folks were coming in. And so it became this center for seekers of all kinds. And all of that got wrapped up in food. People were open to so many ideas. I mean, you know, there were lots of yoga teachers in LA in the 1910s and 20s.
Hmm.
The LA Times started up a column on alternative health in 1899, and it ran all the way through the 1940s. Starting in the 30s, but by the 50s and 60s, it was really the center of the health food movement.
When did it all start to shift to an Eastern angle?
I think when you talk to counterculture folks about why they became vegetarian, there was a core group that really switched because they were following Indian gurus or, you know, Vedantic spiritual practitioners. Those practitioners started teaching in Southern California in the early part of the 20th century. The counterculture's interest in Asian spiritual practices, which really led to a flourishing of Zen Buddhism, you know, as well as macrobiotics and yoga and transcendental meditation, those all got sort of woven together. They all influenced, I guess, a way of folks who were trying to find a different way of living in the world. And so they offered some different paths to people. So that all got intertwined with their desire to rethink their lives in other ways, including what they ate.
It was a gradual transition from one era, one period to the next, but there were a few places along the way where a few things just stood out. The Jack LaLanne, for example, he was part of this. He wasn't just some guy on TV who was doing exercises. He was really part of this movement.
Yeah. And if you read his cookbooks from the 1950s and 60s, they read like the cookbooks from, 30 years later. Although he did like his generation liked liver a little bit more than the counterculture folks.
You talk about tofu being the political dish. Why?
Tofu's been around in America since the 1840s, 1850s, because of the Chinese-American and Japanese-American communities on the West Coast, specifically. But in the 1970s, there was a second wave of interest in vegetarian diets, and a lot of that was sparked by Frances Moore LaPay. She was sort of a grad school dropout who was living in Berkeley, who had been involved in social work, but she got fascinated with hunger and all of these reports that were coming out, and also sort of scare books like Famine 1975 that were suggesting that the earth had passed its carrying capacity and that global famine was going to become endemic, and it was going to inspire all of this political turmoil and could bring down the social order. And so she decided to actually look at what the root causes of global hunger might be. So she went to UC Berkeley, the Agricultural Economics Library. She spent a year down there looking at UN crop reports and USDA nutritional guidelines. And she came to the conclusion that actually the world was producing, especially in America, we were producing so much corn and soybeans to feed animals in order to create meat, that if we fed those grains and legumes to humans instead, we could solve global famine. And so she came out with this book, Diet for a Small Planet, where she advocated that. And not only did she do that, she offered recipes. And she offered this idea that, what we choose to eat, what we buy in the grocery store or the food co-op or whatever, has much larger ramifications beyond our own choices. And I think that book, which came out in 1971, was really pivotal in the natural food movement. You have to understand that like the Green Revolution was actually just taking off when her book came out. So all of the sort of these horrific Malthusian projections about global famine and political instability were actually solved by the Green Revolution and advances in breeding and the adoption of pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, and mechanical farming. So scientists actually solved that particular problem and then introduced a whole new series of them.
You're listening to Jonathan Kaufman, author of the bestseller Hippie Food. He was in conversation with Cap Radio Reads host Donna Appadoni. Their conversation continues after a short break. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Hippie Food is a new bestseller written by Jonathan Kaufman. He talked with Donna Appadoni before a live audience for a Cap Radio Reads event earlier this year. In this part of the conversation, Kaufman talks about his investigation into where certain foods come from.
I went looking for the source of tahini, like how tahini got picked up by the counterculture. After tamari or soy sauce, it was like the number two seasoning. And I was talking to the cook at the communal restaurant who was saying that she used to joke that, when she had kids, she would name them tahini and tamari. I never found, the person. Definitely there was a Lebanese community that, dates back to the early 20th century in different cities around the country. And so I think that they definitely were making a lot of these products available and things like falafel. Part of it also had to do with travel and the counterculture's love for travel. And air travel became so much cheaper in the 1970s that for college-educated kids, going abroad became a rite of passage rather than this very rare thing. So you had all of these kids who were flooding into Europe and backpacking around Europe and taking the train. But then you also had the hippie trail that started in Amsterdam and went overland across Turkey and then Afghanistan and Iran, which were still open, into India and Nepal. That also became a rite of passage, combined with that interest in Indian spirituality, to really bring about a lot of interest and new exposure to Middle Eastern and Southern Asian foods.
where did yogurt come from? I mean, I know where yogurt came from, but it seemed like all of a sudden, one day, everybody around me was eating yogurt and none of them had before. It was just like the snap of a finger. And it was the fruit at the bottom kind for a while, you know, and then we grew up and found some other possibilities.
Yogurt had always had been around the United States since the early 20th century with Armenian immigrants and folks from the Middle East, you know, very small communities around the Northeast. But it really made its way into health food circles because of a scientist from the early 20th century who'd done some studies of Bulgarian peasants, maybe it was the 19th century, and there was this population that he was studying that was living into their hundreds, and he thought it was because they were eating so much yogurt. So you could find yogurt in health food stores in the 1950s and the 60s, but what made yogurt particularly appealing to counterculture folks was that you could make it yourself. My parents got a yogurt maker and, you know, yogurt culture, and they started making their own yogurt. And, you know, we had all these battles over how much jam I could put in that so to make it sweet, you know, and when they weren't looking, it would, you know, mm-hmm. But.
For as many times as I've looked through the Tassajara bread book, it never really sunk in until I read Hippie Food. To make one's bread was a rite of passage from being a prisoner to being free.
White bread, what they would call plastic bread, this sort of super soft, squishy, you know, chemical-enabled and, you know, adulterated bread, became a symbol for everything that was wrong with the food supply. And you know, I talked to, like, countless folks who grew up in the 50s, like, pelting their siblings with, you know, squishing it up into little balls and pelting their siblings with it. So brown bread, whole wheat bread, became the opposite of it. To make your own bread with whole wheat flour and do it yourself, you were taking control of your health. And it tasted so different that even if you didn't necessarily like it, you were going to fight your way toward liking it. And as a kid, I hated it.
Well, there are different kinds of wheat bread. There are different consistencies, different textures, different levels of that. And wheat bread has gone in and out of fashion several times from then until now. What is the fashion of bread? Why does that happen?
I think because it's, in some ways, because it's so basic a staple in the diet, you know, in the American diet, because it takes up such a big space on the grocery store shelves, I think. Yeah, I mean, after people were making all of this dense, hearty whole wheat bread, then the crusty French breads that really took an expert, you know, who was trained in French technique or Italian technique to make the breads, that kind of became the fashion, the gourmet fashion. And then thanks to, you know, Atkins, then bread went out of style. So it really has to do with all these different competing forces, our ideas of nutrition. You know, and now sourdough, it's a sort of the new wave of bakers who are combining that 1960s knowledge with some new craftsmanship. And it is fascinating.
We're talking about food as a pathway to freedom. We're talking about food as a way of revolution. And yet there was this whole phase in the book Hippie Food, in the era of hippie food, that involved casseroles, which just seems to contradict everything I just said.
Well, they were repurposing some of the food they grew up with. I think counterculture folks were. That was such a big part of the 1950s and 60s. But I think the other part of it is that so many kids were trying to cook all of these new foods, but they had no money, and you were often living with a bunch of people, so food was made en masse. So many of the recipes are ginormous. So I think a casserole was great because it fed so many.
And when in doubt, add cheese.
Exactly. Right?
Other than what you have just mentioned, there was such a strong sense of spirituality. And you talked about the Eastern philosophies coming into play. But there is also just that sense of not just freedom, but that sense of soul searching and soul finding. Or maybe something about the people who were making those recipes that seemed to be a deeper sense of self that was coming out.
I do think some of that came from the psychedelic revelations of the late 60s, and I think a lot of the early counterculture folks who were doing a lot of psychedelics, it really opened them up to new ways of looking at the world and looking beyond capitalism and looking beyond sort of achievement. But I also think that you know, in general, but more broadly, that appealed to parents, people like my parents. Just that idea that it was this feeling of discontentment with the political process and with sort of the direction that that generation had grown up with, the ideas that they had to move toward, and just this openness to looking anywhere for newer directions that were more humane and smaller scale.
Were your parents aware that they were doing something that was kind of counterculture? Or were they just looking at it as something that was healthier than what they had been eating before?
That's a good question. You know, I haven't asked them that. I think they were definitely aware that they were part of their generation. They were a little bit older than the counterculture, about 5 or 6 years. They definitely dressed a little more the part, you know, big sideburns and sort of, you know, flowy dresses. But I think they were also very connected to their own tradition, to the Mennonite tradition. I felt much more connected to my extended relatives and the sort of the more conservative Mennonites around me than I did to anything involving the hippies.
Was it a natural part of the Mennonite culture there in Indiana, because it varies from place to place, region to region? Were food co-ops in place in the Mennonite community?
In northern Indiana, which has the second biggest Mennonite population in the country after Pennsylvania, which a lot of people don't know, the Mennonites, partly because of diet for a small plant and more with less, got really involved in the co-op movement. There was a massive network of co-ops and co-op suppliers that sprung up coming out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, stretching from Ann Arbor all the way up to Madison and the Twin Cities. There was this thing called the Michigan Federation of Food Co-ops, and it was a wholesaler that supplied hundreds of buying clubs and food co-ops throughout the Midwest. And so Mennonites in northern Indiana really hooked into that network and got involved in that food co-op movement.
And the co-ops, as you explained in the book, and our SAC food co-op has been in business since 1975, because you wrote considerable pages about co-ops, and a lot of them didn't last long.
No.
And a lot of them are not around anymore.
No.
Very few. So why didn't they work out?
I think there was a lot of naivete around how to run a business, sometimes to ludicrous levels, partly because in the 1970s co-op movement, you as a member were also an owner, very much an owner-directed movement where, you know, if you were an owner, you would get together in these meetings to determine the future of the co-op, which meant, you know, 3 and 4 hour long meetings where you would argue over everything from bananas to, you know, sugar.
There was a lot of democracy.
There was a lot of democracy. But really, I think the main thing that brought down the co-ops was the changing economics. Real estate was very, very cheap in the 1970s compared to the 1980s. And labor was cheap, and the laws around volunteering and volunteer labor were nowhere near as stringent as they are now. So you could start up one of these small businesses and operate it, you know, anti-capitalistically very easily. But once folks grew up a little bit more, they had kids, they decided they needed to make more money, so they had to find jobs, they had less time, those fragile, beautiful organizations collapsed. So it was really the food co-ops that either switched to a worker-owner model or that just really decided, made the hard decisions in the 80s to become more business-oriented and give up a lot of their 1970s spirit that ended up surviving.
You mentioned a couple of the cities that where you have worked, where you have lived, and in the book you talk about the cities where this movement really started to take off.
There were definitely scenes happening in a lot of different places. Boulder, Colorado, Iowa City, Iowa, Madison, Wisconsin.
Why Iowa? How did that happen?
University towns became really the kind of the cultural capitals of this movement, even if they were smaller ones. Like Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor played such an outsized role in the national scene, in University of Michigan. But also, I mean, this was the Back to the Land movement took folks from cities and moved them all over the country, like redistributed the population and to a small degree. And so, you know, there are these pockets in the Ozarks and you know, parts of Wisconsin where, and the entire state of Vermont that changed because of the counterculture settling there.
With everything old being new again, what do we want to revive from 1960, 65, 70? What were they doing right, really right, that we might want to revive?
Well, I'm still moved by the sentiment, kind of the prevailing sentiment of the co-op movement, which was food for people, not for profit. and the anti-capitalist spirit of that movement, even though it's much harder to run a co-op now for all these structural reasons. What I think the piece that I still critique of the modern day sustainable food movement that I took from researching hippie food and kind of reevaluating the food that I grew up with was that it actually in some ways was a home-based movement. These recipes were simple, they were hearty, they were made for you to make in big amounts. They were made to be an everyday cuisine. And I think a lot of the sustainable food of today is really based on restaurants or it's informed by chefs, and it becomes a lot more inaccessible to make. It's tastier, it's more colorful, I enjoy eating it a lot more, but it can feel a lot more difficult to eat in this way than you know, if you were just grabbing a bag of brown rice and cooking up some soybeans and making a casserole with some sprouts and a lot of cheese.
When I talk to people about food in the 60s and say, what should we never do again? They usually say things like Jell-O molds with whip and chill.
Yeah.
And those little maraschino cherries that you would put in there. What is the worst thing about hippie food?
Well, I mean, I was traumatized as a kid by some of the ingredients, so I have a very different view.
Yeah, you're a little biased.
Yeah, for me, my kryptonite was carob, because as a child, it would be the sweet that you were allowed to get from the co-op.
Oh,
and
but
it was
you really
supposed
wanted
to be chocolate.
And
it just really wasn't. Yeah.
You're dealing with that, though, right?
I still am. I still try and taste it now and then. It's still not good.
All right. Now we're going to move to the part where Jonathan gets to read.
So this comes from a sidebar that I wrote about granola and how it, you know, the origins of granola really date back to the Seventh-day Adventists and John Harvey Kellogg, who was he basically ripped off a cereal that his competitor made called granola. But the early granola, or granula, were these big blocks of coarse wheat that you would cook and then bake and then crack, and then you'd have to soak them in milk overnight to make them digestible. It was like a big cake of wheat nuts. But in the 1950s and 60s, granola evolved. The cereal wasn't just good with milk. Young long-haired types discovered that you could stick it in your knapsack for snacking on long hikes or road trips. In the early 1970s, granola was so connected to the underground that Seth Tibbett, founder of Tofurky, remembers buying it in head shops. In 1971, the Ann Arbor Sun published a news item about a high school principal in Minnesota who confiscated granola from one of his students, telling the kid, "Granola relates to drugs, drugs relate to hippies, hippies relate to," he holds his fingers in the peace sign, "and the peace sign relates to an unjust peace." But the counterculture was never content to buy what they could make themselves. Another Adventist, Rosalie Hurd, included some of the first published recipes for modern granola in her popular 1968 vegetarian cookbook, 10 Talents. And recipes proliferated. Mother Earth News published a recipe. So did scores of underground newspapers. By the 1970s, granola recipes appeared in Joy of Cooking and small-town newspapers like the Yuma Sun in Arizona. Almost every whole grain bakery in the country supplemented its income by selling granola to local food co-ops and natural food stores. Some also produced a non-cooked version they called Familia. Granola was also one of the first health foods that big business co-opted. Pet Incorporated introduced the granola-like Heartland cereal, and Quaker Oats released 100% natural granola in 1972, both of which were so successful, every major cereal company came out with its own version in the next couple of years. Crunchy granola, the original brand, eventually faded away, perhaps doomed by the competition. But its memory slithered into the collective subconscious of Generation X, who would call anyone in possession of a tie-dye shirt and a Coexist bumper sticker crunchy or granola.
That was author Jonathan Kaufman reading from his book Hippie Food. He spoke with Cap Radio Reads host Donna Appadoni in front of a live audience in April of 2019. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.